I do not think that I should apologize.
Truth is never illustrated through the use of violence. This is one of the guiding principles that sits at the core of the illuminated thinking created by the man known to the world as Mahatma, the Great Soul, moral and spiritual teacher, founding father of India. Against the violation of human rights, and even when provoked, he would refuse to denounce his aggressors, ever more convinced that non-violence is the only way to combat violence itself. On the basis of his traumatic experiences in South Africa, Gandhi developed the concept of satyagraha, that literally means adhering unflinchingly to the truth. As Gandhi saw it, physical force is only used by weak people. Real strength resides in a person's capacity to express their ideals. On the 11th of September 1906, Gandhi publicly proclaimed his philosophy for the first time. Public support was virtually universal. One must never oppose arrest. One must never oppose the law. One must never respond to violence with violence. But one must strive to affirm vigorously the will of the people and uphold religious freedom.
Thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, Jeff Foe explains why the major political parties have no plans to remedy America's unemployment inequality or long economic slide.
This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Jeff Faw explains why neither party's leaders have a plan to remedy America's unemployment, inequality, or long economic slide that America's political and economic elite spent so long making. While Republicans and Democrats brawl in public, in effect, they have already cut a deal. The American dream will have to be sacrificed.
Now Foe takes us on an historical tour of the rise and fall of the idea that democratic government has a responsibility for shaping the future, and delivers a savage indictment of Wall Street financiers and their Washington toadies who promote an age of austerity for the people and an age of gluttony for themselves.
Jeff Farr, renowned economist, founding president of the Economic Policy Institute, author of The Global Class War and The Servant Economy, where America's elite is sending the middle class. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
I want to start out with one of the always remarkable quotes that you started out with by Yogi Berra. The future ain't what it used to be. Or maybe the subtext there, the hell with the American dream. I want to start from the back and work our way into the crisis. Okay. Good gracious, what is in front of the populace as you see it?
Well, The Servant Economy, which is the name of this recent book that I did, is about where the economy is headed for most Americans. You know, there's a whole academic industry about where America is going. Is China going up? Is America going down? And that's really all about the power of the American elite. But if you ask the question about where is the average American working family going, then you get a much, much different and sober answer. And that's the answer that everybody is interested in. The servant economy describes where I think we're going to be in another 10 or 15 years. And we're certainly headed down that line in that direction right now. You know, nobody really knows the future. But if you're on a ship and you're headed for the rocks and the captain's not changing course, you've got a pretty good idea of what's ahead of you. So if you look around, the evidence is all there. We've had 30 years of flat wages and benefits for the average American. Now, that doesn't mean nobody got a raise in those 30 years. But if you take people with a similar profile, let's say a 35-year-old male college graduate in 1979, and that same type person in 2007, 2008, before the crash, they were making roughly the same in hourly pay. We know why that is. It's the trade deals that favor Americans who invest overseas over Americans who work here. It's the attack on the bargaining position of labor, not just union workers, but all workers. It's the deregulation of finance that has been diverting capital from job-creating investment to short-term speculation. It's the attack on domestic government, privatization. We know that. Now, one of the things that's made it difficult for people to sort of stare at the reality is that over those 30 years, until the crash, things looked good. You looked around in America, and people were going to shopping malls, people were buying houses, people were spending $3 or $4 on a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And the economics of that is this. There were two cushions that protected the average American worker from the fact that their wages were stagnant. One of that, well, those cushions was more women went to work. Essentially, it was this family strategy was to send more family workers out so that the income, total income, could be maintained. Now we've exhausted that. There's more women in the workforce than there are men, and so that's gone. The second cushion was easy credit, and with the bust that happened in 2008, 2009, with Americans strangled in debt, millions of families owing more on their homes than their homes are worth, that cushion has been deflated. So you don't have to be an economist to understand that if incomes were kept up by these cushions or these props, and these props are kicked away, the incomes are going to fall. So wages are now dropping across the board. Pensions are disappearing. Outsourcing is rampant, not only overseas, but outsourcing to labor contractors who hire worker without benefits, without any security. You know, the president had the head of GE do a ceremony in Kentucky when they bought the production of a certain type of water heater from China to Kentucky. And everybody, the press went wild. Oh, this means jobs are coming back from China. What they didn't say was those jobs here used to pay $22 an hour. Now they're paying $12 an hour. And that is the trend. Among college graduates, for example, the hourly wages have been falling for the last 10 years. Now, some people say, well, let's have patience. The economy will recover. And part of the message of my book is the economy has recovered. This is what this new era looks like. We're going to create more jobs, but you won't be able to make a living on them. Anything done with a computer now can be offshored, which means not only manufacturing, but all those high-end service jobs that were supposed to go to American college graduates.
Jeff, I wanted to ask you about one point. I mean, there's a number of different points, but one of them has to do with manufacturing, and it has to do with all the free trade agreements that we've been sold upon, and indeed we're going to be sold upon with another one fairly soon with the Pacific Rim. Yep. And those have been said to us, well, we're just going to be doing stuff that we're most efficient at, and the other countries are going to be doing stuff that they're efficient at, and it's a win-win.
Well, people were making that case 20 years ago, and when all this started, sort of free trade mania under Reagan, and then Bush, and then Clinton. And maybe 20 years ago, you could have believed that. You could have believed that American workers would go up the skill ladder, and oh, we'd leave the stuff on the bottom, the assembly line, you know, sleeping at the factory floor, the low-wage factory jobs, to the Mexicans or the Chinese. That hasn't happened. American workers have not gone up the ladder. And what we've learned now, and this is the chilling thing, anything that can be done by a computer can be outsourced where labor is cheaper. Not only manufacturing jobs, not only engineering and design, which now we know follows manufacturing, because engineers have to be there on the assembly line looking at that, at how you make this stuff before they come up with new stuff, but accounting, lawyers, market research, all this stuff is being outsourced. So what have we got left? If you look at the projections by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they project that between 2010 and 2020, of the 10 fastest growing and biggest categories of jobs between in those 10 years, that only one category requires a college education. One category requires 2 years of college. Four categories don't even require a high school education. So we're talking now about a future, especially a future for young people who have gone to college, come out with huge debt, a future of waiting on tables, cleaning houses, retail clerks, if you're lucky, teaching tennis to the children of the rich. You know, you go into Apple, it's everybody's idea of the future. And it is, but the future is not so much in the technology, the Chinese equipment that they're selling you. The future is all those smart kids in Apple working for 10 to 12 bucks an hour with college educations and debts they can't pay off and no future. They're essentially retail clerks.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
So you're suggesting that not only have we recovered, if you will, but that the status quo is going to be maintained, that there is no way to push forward with capital to drive up the wages anymore. Well, if that is so, why is that the case? Is that the inactivity of the working class, of organized labor, to push for that? Or is it a necessity for the survival of capital, which is indeed in some form of crisis and will just continue to drive further nails in the wages and benefits, if you will, of the working class?
There's several big questions there. Let me take the first part of it. The logic of this is not that it necessarily has to be inevitable. I mean, there are specific things that were done, especially since the era of Reagan, which ended the 50 years of the era of Roosevelt. And, you know, I've written several books in the past where I have this last chapter on here are my 10 points, here are my 6 points, here are my 8 points. And I'm tired of that. We know what to do, not just myself. I mean, you know, people like Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz. I mean, people who are Nobel Prize winners, not left-wing cranks, you know, have been laying out what sensible policy might be. So just holding the question of the final crisis of capitalism, we know what to do. The question is, if we continue the way we're going, I think it's clear that the trajectory is to what I have called the servant economy. And you're right, Mimi. It's not just about wages, and it's not just about, you know, benefits and vacation pay. It's about the social relationships on the job. And we're headed for a world that's going to be more like what it was before the New Deal. You know, the boss used to have an iron fist. The New Deal made that a hand, not a fist. The boss is still in charge. Mm. But there are limits. But we're going to go back to where people are desperate for jobs, and the humiliation, the dignity, you know, asking permission to go to the bathroom, 100 things that existed in the old days, still exist in some places here. But we're going to see a change in the basic social relationships between workers and capital to where it was before the New Deal. Now, the political part of your question, it seems to me, is there's a huge amount of denial going on. You know, that the Republicans are doing what they're doing and working for the upward redistribution of income and power is not a surprise. But what has changed over the last 20 or 30 years is that the Democrats, while they might give lip service to the need for more government here or there, some more help for the poor, but basically they have gone along with it. And so the political system is in denial. You know, the Washington, this campaign is full of this stuff about, well, we need to have some sort of a grand bargain. And, you know, Obama and the Republicans, or Romney and the Democrats, you know, we have to get together. Well, they've gotten together. The grand bargain they're talking about is how much taxes should be cut for the rich. And the grand bargain they're talking about is how much program public investment in the future should be cut. The point I make is that there are of the three great American dreams, the dream of the corporate community for deregulation and unlimited profit. Secondly, the dream of the Pentagon and the military industrial complex for global dominance. And third is the middle class dream for rising living standards. We could, the first 3 or 4 decades after World War II, we could afford both. No matter where you stand politically, we had the resources to do that. We can't now. And so what's happening, although nobody's going to acknowledge this, what's happening is that the decision has already been made. The middle-class dream is going to have to be sacrificed. That's where they're going. Now, the other part of this also is that that among the populace, there's denial, and we should acknowledge that. If you ask Americans in the polls, you think the next generation is going to be worse off than this generation. Majorities say yes. But if you ask, you know, the individual, well, are you going to be worse off in the future? Or your kids going to be worse off? And you get this surprising answer, oh, no, I'm going to be okay. My kids are going to be okay. Well, they're not going to be okay. And until we face that they're not going to be okay the way we're going, I'm afraid we're going to end up where I think we're headed.
Jeff, one of the reasons, or perhaps the main reason why you say both political parties are complicit in basically the pouring of America is that finance capital, especially the banks and the securities companies, have basically bought both parties. First of all, in terms of the new regulations for the banks, do you think that they'll be of any use? And do you think that we need basic structural reform of the banks and perhaps nationalization of some of them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, all of the sound and fury about the Dodd-Frank reform bill and all of the avowal part of Washington, they're going to not let this happen again, and we're going to teach Wall Street a lesson. I mean, Wall Street, as cynical about Wall Street as I was, I have been really surprised at how easily they rolled Washington. So, number one, I don't think that the regulations that we've got are going to stop another one. They're not going to stop the big banks and financiers from doing what they were doing before. And I think you can argue that it's going to encourage them. But now they know that they will be bailed out. Now they know that they can do the same thing they did before, and Washington is going to come to the rescue. When we decided not to break them up or not to nationalize them, you know, that was, and of course nobody's going to jail, that was the signal. So, I mean, this is human nature, that if you get away with something and you're getting all the benefits from, breaking the rules of the activity you're doing, and nobody's going to stop you, then you're going to continue it. So, yes, I think that, my own view was that what we should at least have done was taken one of the large banks that we bailed out and made that a government-run bank. You know, just like in the New Deal, one of the energy companies collapsed, the utilities collapsed. It was a huge Wall Street debacle. Out of that came the idea of public power. So we had TVA, which was a government-owned project. So we had public utilities around the country. And the idea was that the public utility would be a model for the private utilities. And, you know, to nationalize all the banks is way beyond the pale of American politics, but it wouldn't have been beyond the pale to take Citibank or to take one of these banks and say, okay, we're going to own them now. We're going to run them as a model. And it's going to be transparent. We're not going to be investing in short-term speculation. We're not going to be taking American capital and sending it to China. And that would have been the sensible, you know, thing to do. But the well of public opinion has been so poisoned by this anti-government lunacy that, you know, that was just, when I proposed that, people's eyes rolled and you know, it was completely impractical. Well, in a sense, it was politically impractical, but that's the kind of thing you need in order for us not to create another bubble and another crash.
You know, one of the things that's going to be on the agenda with the introduction of Paul Ryan to the Republican ticket is absolute abject hysteria around the deficit, the Obama administration having the largest deficit in recorded history for any sitting president, etc. And the media will beat that drum as well. What's wrong with the American working class that we can't get to the depth, the profundity of the issues and immerse ourselves in and buy into this general sloganeering of really actually the Republicrats? I mean, we buy into our own austerity budgets that are being foisted upon us by the really power elite.
Well, I think several things. You know, one is that the Democratic, we have a two-party system here. You know, you can imagine another kind of system, but that's all we've got. And therefore, it's the responsibility of the Democratic Party to really provide the alternative, to really provide the arguments about the importance of, for example, the public sector and the notion that we deal with this economic crisis by cutting back on government spending. That was the disaster that we learned in the Depression. We got out of the Depression when we started to spend for World War II. Now, that's a hell of a lesson that we learned. And yet, again, you could expect the Republicans who speak for big dollar and the big money, you know, to do what they're doing. You expect Ryan and Romney to do what they're doing. But the Democrats are supposed to be something different. And ever since Reagan's election, under Clinton and under Obama, there has not been the strong message to the American working people explaining some of these simple notions of economics. It's not too hard to make the case. I mean, Ross Perot made the case with a couple of charts. Obama could get up there with a couple of charts and say, listen, when the consumers aren't spending because they don't have any jobs and they're in debt, when business is not investing because customers are not coming in the door to buy their products, there's only one entity left to spend and to keep people working, and that's the government. And yet they are just, their knees tremble when they have to go and defend the government. Now, somebody ought to get up and say, listen, this is a big country. We've got big problems. To solve them, we need big government. Imagine somebody saying that today. We need, and yet, people can understand that. Are we going to run this country with a government the size of Honduras? No. And then you have Ryan and these guys who are fashioning themselves as budget cutters. And he wants to leave the military budget intact. Well, that's not a budget issue. That's a values issue. And so I think that a lot of it is the Democrats not pulling their weight and doing what they're supposed to do in this two-party system. But I do think there's something else. I think that the working class, many Americans, still have this hope that, this is America, things will turn out okay. They always have in the past, and so they always will be in the future. And so there's a sense that, we don't have to get too involved. We don't have to get, as you said, maybe we don't have to delve into these issues. That's too complicated. Rather, watch TV, because I'm going to be okay. And part of my message is they're not going to be okay. They and their children are not going to be okay unless they do just exactly what you said. And I think one of the first things we've got to do, when you step back and look at the political problem in America, the central political problem is the big money's influence in politics. Now, that's been going on for a long time. But since Citizens United, the lid is off. I was in a restaurant 3 days ago. I could see the TV in the bar, and I counted 7 vicious, really anti-Obama ads in the space of about 32 minutes. So this blitz is going on, and the Democrats are not going to stop it by, just saying, oh, yeah, well, we're for cutting, too. We're going to cut. Obama is talking about cutting $500 billion from Medicare. Jesus. James Baldwin, the great American writer, once said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed unless it is faced. And I think we've got to face the trajectory and where this economy is going, and it's dragging down the vast majority of working people in this country who, in some ways, people, are not completely their head in the sand. When the Occupy Wall Street thing started in the fall, and the polls show that if you ask people about the issues that Occupy was talking about, they agreed with them. Now, they turned on the television and they saw these gruffy people, and there was a cultural problem here. But on the issues of jobs, on the issues of offshoring to China, and on the issue which I think is the most important, on the issue of money in politics, most people agree with what is the progressive view, even people in the Tea Party. So part of the distrust of government is that they think government's on the side of the big guys, and they're right. After 4 years of Obama, this great liberal president, bailing out all the banks, and the average American, liberals might not like it, but it's true, the average American is worse off now than when he started as president. Now, you can blame a lot of this on Bush, et cetera. But Obama is ironic because he was a teacher. He was a professor. You'd think he'd be good at teaching people some of the basics about why things are where they are and the power system. Not, and in many ways, when Obama says, I don't care how rich people get, and this is a much-used mantra by the Democrats. Oh, I'm for people getting as rich as they want in America. Well, I'm not for getting people as rich as they want in America, because the richer that people get, the more they influence politics, and it turns a democracy into a plutocracy.
Well, that's a note to leave things on. So we have a lot of work, and part of our work is to continue to build our theoretical and academic and ideological base to do the work that we must. So I encourage people to read Where America's Elite is Sending the Middle Class, The Servant Economy, with author Jeff Foe. And I thank you very much for your thoughts and for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and you do good work. We all have to keep working at this.
Thank you, Jeff. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash.
Kiss me goodbye and write me while I'm gone. Goodbye, my sweetheart. Hello, Vietnam.
America has heard the bugle call. And you know it involves us one and all. War will ever end. There's fighting that will break us up again.
Goodbye, my darling. Hello, Vietnam. A hill to take, a battle to be won. Kiss me goodbye.
America has trouble to be stopped. We must stop communism in that land, or freedom will start slipping through our hands.
Kiss me goodbye and write me while I'm gone. Goodbye, my sweetheart. Hello, Vietnam.
And now for something completely different.